Planet Earth, an age of abundance. It's an era of entertainment in which mankind suffers from a loss of direction and a paralyzing plethora of leisure choices. Only the Vox Duo can navigate the deluge of delight that is the Golden Age.
I'm Joe Martin.
And I'm Adam Voley, and we're here to ask each other one very simple question about Wonder Woman.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
I was completely entertained. I just got back from the movie, so I saw it about an hour and a half ago, and I was entertained from pretty much the opening sequence straight through to the end. I never lost my enjoyment. And never lost just the sense of fun going through the movie start to finish, which I've got to tell you, coming from DC and Warner Brothers, I was honestly expecting to have no fun whatsoever and to be sitting through it mostly out of a sense of obligation. But I was very pleasantly surprised.
Hooray! Well, good. I was hoping you'd like it. I wasn't certain, honestly, but I was hoping. Yeah, I agree. It's no Iron Man, but I would rank it at about the first Captain America, you know, an upper mid-tier range Marvel movie, if you will. I think it's got a sense of fun, as you said, and it's got all the right elements. Great plot, really smart theme work, I thought, grand casting and action sequences. All I have are nitpicks, little missteps that took me out of what was an otherwise thoroughly enjoyable experience, and we'll get to those, I'm sure. But yeah, that's Wonder Woman to me.
Yeah, I would agree. I got a very strong... I saw your comment about Captain America on Twitter before going into the movie. And I would agree, it felt very similar to the first Captain America movie, which I also really enjoyed. You know, the fact that it's now considered a mid-tier Marvel movie, to me, doesn't detract from my enjoyment of it in any way. It was a thoroughly enjoyable, charming movie when it came out. From just a pure fun perspective, it's still one of my favorites. And the fact that I rank Wonder Woman right there is honestly a high compliment. I did get strong Captain America vibes just in terms of story structure and some of the plot elements. But at this point, my opinion of the DC movies is low enough that I think they could do worse than borrowing from Marvel.
Than to just Xerox Marvel films and replace their characters with Marvel's. No, Captain America, the first one, is in my top... five, probably, Marvel movies, even though, you know, a lot of people would disagree with that. Well, great. I want to start off with something, with Wonder Woman, the character, you know, even the source material, and I'm curious what you know about her. I guess, has she popped up on the Justice League cartoons you watch with your kids?
She has, and that's pretty much my entire exposure to her, is watching Justice League. If she has appeared in Batman, the Brave and the Bold, it's only been once or twice. She has been in a handful of Justice League cartoons. So that's pretty much my entire knowledge of her.
Well, mine's not great. You know, being a lifelong comics fan, you kind of absorb by osmosis a lot of information about big two characters, especially iconic ones like Wonder Woman. I've read two comics from her actual series, maybe. So I knew, or I had a good idea of who the villain was, and I know the basic concept, which is that, which is interesting in itself. It's a little dated. You know, this was written by a feminist from the 1930s, but, you know, he still had these ideas that we don't really truck with anymore, that essentially women were the good sex. And so, you know, what we need is a woman from an island of women to come to the world of men that has been despoiled and to teach us how to live again and teach us about peace, and so forth. And, you know, this was before, this was a good 50 years before the world had heard of Margaret Thatcher. So, it's dated a little bit, and they keep it without quite going there. I thought they did a really good job. You probably don't know this, but Alan Heinberg, the screenwriter, has actually written Wonder Woman comics.
I did not realize that, and that might explain why it felt like it was written by someone who actually knew what he was doing.
Yeah, if I were going to read any Wonder Woman comics, actually, I had to look through the available comics afterwards, wondering if there was anything I'd like to follow up on. He'd be a good option, because he's like Joss Whedon. He's obviously from Hollywood, but he's considered a good writer who knows the medium, and he just dabbles now and then in comics and leaves people wanting more.
Sorry, I got distracted. I was looking at the cast on IMDb, and it's got the pictures next to everybody. And one of the German commanders is apparently Wolf Kaler, and the picture they've got for him is him in a Nazi uniform from, if I'm not mistaken, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Well, so, awesome. That was one of the points that I'm going to make later, that this film somewhat confuses Germans in World War I with Nazis in World War II. so that makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah, okay, so I loved it. You loved it. I don't know about your wife. Did your wife see it?
No, she did not. She pretty much avoids most of the superhero movies, just, I think, out of a sense of boredom more than anything else.
Got it. Well, my wife went bananas for it, and female geeks in general, of course, have. I do want to say, like, a word about, I know this is a review of the movie, but I want to say a word about the gender politics real quick, because obviously that was a big part of it going in, the expectations and the pressure, really, that the film was on under. I get that. I don't know if you saw Mad Max Fury Road.
I did not.
Well, my wife and I went to see it because we heard it was good. Weren't interested at all, but the word of mouth was so great for it. And there's a breakout character in it, and she's not the star, but her name is Furiosa, and she has at least half the movie, as it turns out. But after we left, my wife was just charged, and she said that this was the first action movie that was really a pumped her up. She said she finally understood them, because it was the first movie that succeeded in putting over a female protagonist enough as a kick-butt heroine to where, you know, she wanted to live vicariously through that woman. And it was really cool for her. I think that's a lot of what everyone's been waiting for with Wonder Woman, and she said she felt that again. It's been a big win as far as that's concerned. And there's a certain line at which I kind of get off the track with that. I love my wife's response. I like how she jumped in the air afterwards, pretty much. I remember I saw some other woman said that she was crying during the whole time, and it's just like, I don't know, you are not a black person seeing Sidney Poitier for the first time, but that goes into my general discomfort with where the line should be drawn as far as how much we should identify with what's ultimately just another consumer-geared package.
Yeah, and I've got some thoughts along those lines myself. You know, I grew up, went through high school and college, and read a large number of books with heroes, action or otherwise, the majority of whom were male, but a decent minority were female. And I would have said that the gender of the character didn't matter. I could identify with both, and honestly, I think as long as the story is written well enough, motivations and emotions and reactions are universal enough that to me it doesn't really matter if it's a male or if it's a female experiencing everything. I can identify with the human experience in the story either way. And I still think that's true to a large degree, but it has been interesting watching TV shows movies, and even listening to music through the eyes and ears of my daughters. It's one of those ways in which having four daughters is interesting, and just the offhand comments that they make along the lines of, you know, we'll be watching a music video and I'll say, hey, would you want to be in a band like that? Oh, well, I couldn't be in a band. It's all boys up there. Oh, well, no. Bands can be boys or girls, either one. Well, yes, but I've only ever seen bands with boys in them. And to a certain extent, superhero stories as well, it's all men carrying the action, so it's a little bit hard, I think, from their standpoint at their age, vicariously putting themselves into that situation, because it seems like just a boy thing. So I think a lot of the gender politics gets overplayed, but I will admit that I have changed my own position on it just through watching their reactions to the stuff we watch. And they thoroughly enjoy Indiana Jones and Back to the Future and Jurassic Park and Captain America and Avengers. But they certainly do notice the gender imbalance and comment on it occasionally. And so from that aspect, I've been looking forward to Wonder Woman for well over a year, just because I knew it would be special for them to have a female character leading the movie rather than following behind.
Yeah, I have found myself wishing that my little sisters were old enough to go see it. Hopefully, when they are old enough, we'll have, you know, 2 to 3 Wonder Woman films out, and Captain Marvel alongside that.
I am really looking forward to Captain Marvel. I got my hands on the first 6 issues of the recent Captain Marvel series that was done. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping there's only one, because otherwise I'd need to qualify with which one of the recent ones. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was a great series of stories, and I thought it was a great character that would make for an entertaining movie. So I'm kind of wishing Marvel would quit dragging their feet and go ahead and produce the thing already.
Oh, cool. I have not read any Captain Marvel comics. The writer, Kelly Sue DeConnick, I've read some of her stuff, and it's all been really good. Bitch Planet and Pretty Deadly are excellent series. Pretty Deadly has 2 volumes out, and they're both self-contained, essentially. It's like the Sandman, you know, these sort of mystical characters who just appear in different eras and have some sort of adventure. Highly recommended. Well, cool.
This is DeConnick, Captain Marvel number 1.
DeConnick is the one who essentially, I'll go ahead and say, built up Captain Marvel for Marvel. They did not give her a lot of support. She spent her own money making a fan club and sending fan club members stickers and, you know, basically just building up that fan base. And it worked. And yet they never even rewarded her with a seat at the writer's table. Mm. That is to say that at Marvel, there's, you know, there's a table of writers or a group of writers who kind of plan out the main storylines for the larger universe. And then there are the satellite writers who do smaller titles.
Who just fill in the details.
Yeah, or get on with their own thing. I think that's a big reason why she left, and also why her husband, who was a table writer for Marvel, left, Matt Fraction. He also has a strong following. Well, all right then, Joe, let's talk about the movie.
Yeah, enough about Marvel. Let's talk DC.
Yeah, you're right. My gosh, the DC bias is real. Even when we want to do a show about a DC movie, we end up talking about Marvel. All right, so yeah.
Just a warning for anyone who's unaware, this episode will be spoiler-filled. I don't think either one of us has any intention of dancing around the details and obfuscating what it is we're talking about. So either spoil yourself thoroughly and then see the movie, or probably better, go see the movie and then come back and listen to us blabber about it.
Right on, and consider that, but do come back, because it's possible that we've caught some stuff that you've missed. All right, so I will say that from start to finish, and I guess going progressively is the way to do this. It wasn't an enjoyable experience for me. I thought the movie picked up with Steve Trevor arriving. The Amazon Island parts were fairly staid for me. The dialogue was supposed to be, you know, kind of not otherworldly, ancient, because this is sort of an island lost in time. But you can easily write staid dialogue in that way, and I thought they did. No, things got good for me when Chris Pine arrived and he was interacting with everybody. That's when my interest was piqued.
Well, I'll go ahead and we'll have our first minor disagreement of the conversation. I will agree the dialogue was staid at the beginning. I was captivated from the first moment just because, holy cow, color. It's a DC movie with bright, vivid colors. Everything actually looked alive and normal. And so I was happy right off the bat that we had that. And then I was utterly captivated by the young actress that they had for Diana. I just thought she was fabulous, and I thoroughly enjoyed every minute that she was on screen.
Which was almost all of them.
Which was almost all of them, which is part of why I think I enjoyed the beginning. So yeah, the dialogue, the rest of the stuff going on, that wasn't so great, but she lit up every scene she was in, and so to the casting department, I say fantastic job plucking her out of wherever you plucked her out of. She sold that first 20 minutes for me.
Israel.
There you go.
Her name's Gal Gadot.
No. Sure. The young one, the 8-year old one.
Oh, okay. The little girl.
Not that I wasn't captivated by Gal Gadot as well, but whoever the young
kid was. I don't see how
was.
You couldn't be. Another parallel with Captain America is that both movies star the prettiest actors in their respective franchises.
There you go.
Yeah, no, seriously, though, a woman on screen hasn't hit me like that since Margot Robbie in 2013, I think. You just want to drink that woman. So you're automatically halfway to good chemistry with the male lead, because any guy on camera is going to look like he wants to kiss her the whole time.
Right, how can you be the male actor and look like you're not responding at that point?
There's no way. Let myself enjoy that. That's actually a very good reason to get the 3D glasses. But for that matter, Chris Pine, I thought, was really charming in this as well. I instinctively liked the guy. He's been good in a lot of recent things. Hell or High Water last year.
I did not see that.
It was one of the Oscar contenders. It's a short story in film mode, really, and not something you're gonna miss, but I thought he did a good job. Into the Woods. No, he's a good leading man. I enjoyed seeing him on screen, and I thought they had really good chemistry.
They did, and you know, I've enjoyed him in each of the three new Star Trek movies. I strongly dislike the three new Star Trek movies, but I strongly like the cast. Those are examples of movies where I think the casting was wonderful and the entire cast has been let down by the script writing and directing and producing. But I've always loved Chris Pine as Captain Kirk. And I thought he did a fantastic job in this movie as well. Going back to the 8-year-old actress that I was impressed with.
Really quick. You know who else is a charming actor? Henry Cavill.
Yes.
It's a real shame. he could have been such a great Superman. There was a recent remake of The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which is not a film you need to track down. It's kind of an action comedy piece. The good parts are not constant, but he is just wonderful in that film. Just hilarious, and you just enjoy every second that he's on screen. But he plays the most dour Superman that has ever been recorded. And after seeing that film, it's just so sad. But to the little girl.
Yeah, to the little girl. Lily Aspel, she's 8. She actually is 8 years old, Scottish-born, and is actually a keen equestrian, this says, doing both acting and show jumping. So the horse scenes, she did not have to fake. So yeah, I thought she was the one who made the first Obviously, when we get to Grown Up Diana and Gal Gadot, but the opening moments of the movie, I thought Lily was the one who kept the whole thing moving for me.
Huh. Well, all right. I can't say she made that much of an impression on me, but she did fine. I wasn't looking for much from the child actor.
Another one of those things where I think if you have kids and you've seen kids acting out fighting, seeing a kid acting out fighting, watching the grown-ups go through training, connects with you on a little bit of a different level.
Maybe so. And then after having sat through all of your daughter's terrible school plays, maybe you recognize good child acting when you see it.
Oh, isn't that the truth?
All right, so talking about the plot, just in general, I thought the plot elements were, the plot was all pretty much exactly what we needed to see in a Wonder Woman movie. In fact, insofar as my feelings about Wonder Woman go, the plot is perfect. The execution is sometimes a little to the left or right, or the dialogue is clunky or whatever, but I thought that, you know, on a sheet of paper, this is pretty much perfect. And I'm a particular fan of this. You don't see it very often, but the doomed quest plot is a personal favorite of mine. Another example that I can think of is AI, Artificial Intelligence, the movie by Spielberg based on Stanley Kubrick stuff, where Haley Joel Osment's android boy is trying to become a real boy. And so he goes on this quest to find the blue fairy. And you understand that there is no such thing as this blue fairy, that he is seriously under misapprehensions here. And it adds this underlayer of tension to the movie, because you know that there's no pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And I really like that. It creates, but because you know that there's, you know, you're left wondering, almost like a how does he get out of this plot? You know, what there can be that will satisfy, if anything. And if you care about the character, then that makes for a compelling story to me. And so in this film, Diana's idea that Ares is behind the Great War provides that same underlying discomfort.
Yeah, I think it does, and you're right. I mean, obviously, Ares is in the movie, but turns out is not the orchestrator of events.
And he didn't have to be. It was a surprise for me that he showed up toward the end, because it was entirely possible that they were saving him for the second movie. You could have finished this movie without Ares.
Right.
You didn't, and I think that's probably in part just because they wanted a big final battle at the end. But the story works without Ares.
Without Ares, I'm not positive you have a reason for Captain Steve to sacrifice himself, although that's something I can think through and work through later, whether I think you still could have had that work. Can I just say, I'm going to assume that her origin story in the comics is in World War I, and I'm going to assume time period and when it was actually written, that makes sense. But from a plot coherency problem, my biggest issue with the whole movie was that this was World War I instead of World War II. Because I think of World War I as the stupid war. It was the mistake. It was the war nobody meant to fight, and there wasn't really a villain on either side. Both sides just kept beating their chests until they kind of accidentally backed into a war that they weren't sure how to get out of, historically speaking. If you want a war where you're going to pitch somebody as the bad guys and you're going to have Ares whispering ideas for hellish plots into people's ears, World War II makes far more sense to me than World War I does.
Well, let me start by saying that no, Wonder Woman is not originally a World War I era character, either in the story or in her creation. although she did fight in a bunch of Nazis, just like all the other characters around during that time. But I think you've mistaken a feature for a bug here. This is a story, again, the central concept of Wonder Woman is a woman who wants to bring peace to the world. And you can't do this story with World War II, because World War II occupies a certain place in most of the world's mindset of being the good war, that everyone was right for fighting. Whereas World War I, as more and more time has gone on, is, as you're right, the stupid war. And so you don't want Wonder Woman arriving in World War II and saying, stop everything, you're all being idiots. you know, you need World War I is where that works. So I think the idea of setting it in World War I was very intentional and a good idea.
And then maybe it's Dr. Poison that's out of place in the movie.
I mean, she doesn't really have such a strong effect on the movie that I think it matters so much. I mean, poison gas obviously was a big thing, and you know, the weapon that was outlawed afterward. So you know, she kind of works as a advancer of the horrors of war.
Look, I have issues with the plot, and you're not going to take this away from me. I'm just going to keep searching.
How about I provide you with something?
let me offer one more thing, and then I think that's my last one. If that gets shut down, I've got nothing left.
Okay.
It's the level of enjoyment that Dr. Poison and General Ludendorff show, the level of gleeful anticipation of the destructive effects of these poisons, and they seem to be enjoying the destructive potential and the pain and the suffering entirely too much. General Ludendorff has a line about your poisons will help us conquer the world, which to me seems a much more World War II statement than a World War I statement. So there was something about that whole, it just, for me, it wasn't gelling.
No, I completely agree with that. Eric Ludendorff is a mistake, in my opinion, as a character. More so than you realize, maybe. I don't know if you caught this, but he's a historical figure.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. The logic of using him, again, is apparent because he literally wrote the book on total war. So that's a great rationale for his inclusion, and hey, obviously, this universe is not our universe, so if you want Wonder Woman to stab Eric Ludendorff through the chest with a sword, fine. Inglourious Bastards showed you could do whatever you wanted with Nazis anyway. But yeah, he's turned into this super strong, scenery-chewing sadist. That creates issues. I understand why they wanted him to be super strong. You know, you can kind of track all this because A, they probably wanted one more battle, and B, you don't want Wonder Woman to look completely murderous when she kills him.
Yes.
So giving him an opportunity to put up a fight helps, but the artificial powers, I think, hurts a bit because you want to build him as as ambiguous. The question of whether or whether he is not Ares is one that you should string readers along on, or not readers, but viewers along on until the final moment. But if he's getting all of his power from a drug, then clearly he is not a god.
That and he is, in terms of is he Ares or is he not, I thought he was too clearly the big heavy to be Ares. I was going to be disappointed in the movie if it was literally that unsubtle, that the guy most likely to be Ares is in fact Ares. So I was quite happy that he was not in fact Ares. I had pegged who was Ares half an hour, 40 minutes earlier in the film. Probably. I wasn't actually looking at my watch. I have no idea. I'm guesstimating.
Okay, but you guessed.
I guessed. Because I was looking for the indirection, and they brought the indirection, happily. But, yeah, in some ways, jacking him up to be so evil, it was probably a deliberate distraction. But again, I think it's just a little bit unfair to General Ludendorff's actual historical character. And I don't know why that bugs me in a superhero film, but it does a little bit. Again, maybe because it's the stupid war rather than the evil war. Why do we need to have a German general who is evil rather than just fanatically dedicated to protecting his homeland?
I don't like it either. He wasn't actually a good guy. In fact, he marched with Hitler on his beer hall push. But yeah, that doesn't really sit well with me either. I would have preferred a more realistic character, and or perhaps even or an original character who you could then do whatever you wanted with. Because I do think it helps to have a truly evil general, because then we can wonder if he's Ares, and also he provides someone with whom to compare the other German generals who are not especially evil for their time period.
And it aids in the, you know, I almost thought you could subtitle this movie, The Education of Diana. And having a truly evil character who's driven by his own motivations rather than by Ares, I think aids in that education of the world is worse than you would like to believe it is.
Mm. I wasn't looking for him. I'm pretty good about doing that. There was a time in my life when I caught all the twists, and so I know I can do it, but I've managed to train myself not to. But I thought it really helped David Thewlis that they cast a man who doesn't really look like a villain and gave him that silly mustache.
Yes.
He just comes off, you know, his figure is so unintimidating, and that's very helpful when you're trying to direct attention away from your villain. I do want to say that if I were the producer or director or whatever, and also David Thewlis' contract allowed for it, I would have subbed him out for another actor when Ares fully manifested. I thought he looked silly in the armor, the same thing that made him a great choice to be cast as the secret bad guy made him difficult to swallow as the god of war. When I looked inside that T-shaped hole in his helmet and saw, you know, his face with a more of a beard, it was incongruous to me.
Yeah, I didn't have as negative a reaction to him in the armor, because once you've buried somebody under that much CGI, who it is matters a lot less. But the scene where they show Ares cast down and he's sitting on the beach defeated and he's wearing that mustache, that's too quintessentially British to work as a defeated Greek god. So I'm with you there. At that point, we needed a different actor who looked more Greek and less upper-class Brit.
Exactly. Some Mediterranean person. So we've talked, we got into the casting, and we talked about the theme, but I want to go back to it real quick, because
sure.
I thought the plot and the theme, I'm no longer a Randian, but I've kept Ayn Rand's idea of the plot hyphen theme, because when you've really got a good idea, they're inseparable from each other. I think she made a lot of sense when she said that. And so this one's great, that the world is more complicated than some evil people being behind it. And once you take him out, the world does not suddenly become a happy place. That's a great modern message. And in fact, it's even better. When Wonder Woman becomes disenchanted, when she realizes that we, mankind, have brought this all on ourselves, she quotes her mother as saying that mankind does not deserve her. And Steve Trevor's reply is fantastic. He makes explicit what I believe is or should be the theme of the movie. He said it's not about what they deserve. It's about what you believe, which is maybe a little too generic. What I would say instead, what I would have written instead perhaps is it's about what you want for them. And then he runs off and Ares arrives and says, as you can see, people suck, and I'm glad you're here, because now we can finally get rid of them. And as a god, of course, he has no problem with this. He remembers the world before mankind. And I would have even liked a little bit more. I thought the visuals were great, but maybe a little bit more explicit dialogue on this subject. You know, you've been on an island forever, so you don't know this, but they've killed off half the species, you know, and, you know, a bunch of other stuff that's indicting us. And the question becomes about, you know, what worth humanity has. But then, and there's usually a line of dialogue like this in a movie, you know, Wonder Woman kind of summarizes the moral when she says right before killing Ares, "They're everything you say and so much more."
Yes.
And I hated that line. In fact, you know, if I could just excise one thing from that whole movie, it would be that stupid piece of dialogue. Because the problem was never that she didn't know people could be good. She left the island thinking they were swell. The problem was that she learned that they were also bad. And that gets it completely backwards. Mm. It was not news that people could also be good, which is what she would have had to learn then. The correct line of dialogue in that scene would have been something like, it's not about what they deserve. It's about what I want for them. You know, she wants us to have peace, and that's why she's fighting.
And I believe she did use, it's not about what they deserve, or she did use, they don't deserve me, something. She took the dialogue that she had with Steve Trevor, and she reversed it around at some point. But you're right, it
I don't recall that. I hope so. I hope you're right, and I just don't remember that part.
it definitely wasn't the climactic, final, crystallizing line, which you're right, I think it should have been. I do see there was an era of disillusionment that she had lost faith even in Steve Trevor and then regained it.
Which is fine, I guess.
Which is fine. And I'm mostly agreeing with you. What that line, I can understand why you don't like that line. It doesn't resonate emotionally as strongly with me. What really clanged to me was Ares' line about even Steve Trevor being dead. And I don't remember the exact line, but it was something to the effect of even he has failed, or even he has destroyed himself, or something that was indicating that he seemingly didn't understand that Steve Trevor had sacrificed himself to prevent the gas from being spread all over the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was the line that needed a response. And maybe that's what they were trying to do with Diana's line. But if so, I thought it fell flat. Something to the effect of, they can be extremely destructive, but they can also be destructive in the service of good. Or I mean, I'm not a writer. I don't know. That's not rolling off the tongue. But something to indicate that the capacity for self-sacrifice does matter.
Yeah, and it's just a shame. I really do wonder if maybe that was a case of ad-libbing on set or something of the like, which happens a lot. Because, you know, it's strange that, you know, a script which has such a good idea, it's always weird and looks weird when a script that has such a good idea of what it's about doesn't get it right toward the end. And I like to think that people are intelligent, and that's usually a sign that somebody was not communicating with somebody else, which is a big reason why uncreative people should just deal with the management side of things, or or even why, you know, a writer should not necessarily... anyway, the real shame of it is that, going back to Captain America comparisons, I don't think Captain America really had a strong theme. It's rare enough when a superhero movie is great, but a superhero movie that says something, like really says something, is a big deal, because movies that say something that are big tentpole pictures are few and far between. You know, the usually you get something like Guardians of the Galaxy or Avengers when it's basically just all, we can do better together, you know, or family or some similar very universal and bland theme that they know nobody will be offended by. Whereas Wonder Woman had a really good message here. You know, it's timely. It's not what they deserve. It's what you want for them. Applies to the Syrian refugee crisis. You know, it applies to healthcare. It applies to crime and punishment. And it really strikes at something that people say a lot, you know, which is that, for example, you should just, if a woman tests positive for drugs, then you should just let her starve, apparently. You know, that is a powerful message, and I would have liked to have seen it strike home.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was thinking, honestly, the parallel I was thinking throughout the movie was there's a lot of people who wish that Trump was not president of the United States right now, and maybe have this fantasy. Oh, heck, not maybe. I know a lot of them have this fantasy that if only we can get rid of Trump some way, somehow, impeachment or a heart attack, whichever, the U.S. will be a better place again. And I think that's fundamentally missing the point, which is Americans have deep divisions and really strongly dislike each other for a host of reasons. And President Trump is a symptom of the disease, not the cause. And just like killing Ludendorff doesn't end the war, killing or removing, not killing, sorry, Secret Service, removing President Trump from office is not going to solve America's problems miraculously. Everyone's not going to join hands around President Mike Pence or President Paul Ryan and sing Kumbaya and get back to healing our divisions. So, yeah, this message that the world is messier than we want, but what's important is what we want for people rather than focusing on what's bad.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that, too. I think that's also a very smart theme. And it's part of, and that is, for me, a lot of what makes this a good movie. And we've talked about this before, but I think of these characters as, or any character, as a vehicle for something else. You know, stories that are about, just about the characters that are starring in them are not great stories. And by that standard, Avengers, for example, which is one of the best superhero movies ever, execution-wise, isn't a great movie, capital G anyway, because it really doesn't have any message except, isn't this great? And the only response to that is, yes it is. But it's not, there's nothing to take away from that other than a good experience.
Yeah, whole point of Avengers was you have always wanted to see all of the Avengers on screen at one time fighting a battle. Here it is. Isn't it as much fun as you always thought it would be? Wait, what? You wanted something more from the movie? Come on.
Totally. I've exhausted, I think, my major points of discussion with the movie. Minor notes. Obviously, the fish out of water stuff was all a lot of fun. I thought the action sequences were very good. They were stamped with Zack Snyder's style, but working within that framework, I thought the director, Patty something, did a good job with him. And the part where she destroys the, or where she takes out the sniper and also the bell tower with the sniper, got a very deserved round of applause in my theater.
That whole battle was really a lot of fun. From the moment she went over the top in the trench till the moment she took out the bell tower, that was fantastic. I loved it. But I thought it said great things for how they had depicted Captain Steve Trevor. And can I just say for a moment how bemused I am, and again, character from the comics, at least I assume so. I don't think they're doing this deliberately, but I've always been fascinated by the Marvel-DC parallels in terms of which characters parallel a character in another universe.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact we've got Captain Steve Rogers, who gets his start in World War II, and Captain Steve Trevor, who shows up here in World War I. Obviously, one's the leading character, one's the side character, but still, that just amused me throughout the entire movie.
Hmm.
That being said, I did enjoy how the filmmakers had him. He's washed up on the beach, on the island. He's watching this pitched battle between the Germans and these Amazonians who are flipping, leaping, and shooting arrows all over the place. And he's observant enough to notice that several of the women yell to another one of the women, "Shield," and she runs over and leaps up off of the shield in order to pull off a maneuver. And there he is in the middle of this battle in this Belgian city, and sees a piece of metal on the ground that he can do the same thing with, and has the guys help him pick it up, hold it, and yell "Shield" over to Diana, who's of course gone through all the training to know how to do this, and does it. And I just thought that was a spectacular tie back of here's something that he saw when he was most likely totally on an adrenaline high, confused about everything going on, and yet he has the presence of mind to remember it later in the story. And I thought that just said really good things about their understanding of his character.
Yeah, I agree. And also, it's a sign of a tight script.
Yes.
Steve Trevor, now, don't quote me on this, but like I said, Wonder Woman is not a World War I era creation. In the original stories, Steve Trevor is just a modern day military pilot, and the same thing happens, which means, of course, that over the last X number of years, he has been a World War II era pilot, he has been a Vietnam era pilot, he has been a Gulf War era pilot.
Poor guy just gets shot down everywhere he goes.
Continuously. He's one of the worst pilots in the expanded universe. And then, of course, he brings Wonder Woman over to the world and is also her love interest as well as her guide. I think he's her government minder, perhaps. And one of those characters like, say, Jimmy Olsen or Snapper Carr or Rick Jones, Hulk the Hulk's buddy, who after that you just kind of keep having to find things for him to do. But I like this solution that Wonder Woman doesn't really age since she's on Paradise Island, or perhaps while she's on Paradise Island is the time when she doesn't age. I don't know how it works, but having him be her long-lost love and be in the World War I film and then be done with works really well, I think. And cheers to Chris Pine for getting that role, because that means that he can do it, but he's not stuck in a 5-picture deal.
Absolutely.
Surgical strike there. Well done, Chris Pine's agent.
Unless he comes back. We all thought Bucky Barnes was dead. Well, those of us who hadn't been reading the comics for years thought Bucky Barnes was dead after the first Captain America movie, and yet here we are, so.
Yeah. He was dead for most of the history of the character. He was one of those characters like Uncle Ben from Spider-Man or Gwen Stacy, who was never supposed to come back. You know, that was just sacrilegious, but Marvel went ahead and rolled those dice, and it actually was a well-received storyline.
And let's pour one out for Uncle Ben, who, as far as I know, has never actually come back, which in a comic book universe is a feat all of its own.
Yeah, no. Clones, afterlife visions, that sort of thing, but never flesh and blood. It's really him.
So I have a couple thoughts of my own on the movie. If we've moved through most of yours, a couple of things I wanted to comment on.
Do it.
So let's talk the DC universe and the use of color, or not, as the case may be. And this seems to be as much a Zack Snyder characteristic as lens flare is a J.J. Abrams characteristic. Zack Snyder seems to be allergic to color, from everything I can tell. And I love the fact that the movie started out with bright colors on Paradise Island. And, okay, so it's foggy and they're leaving at night and there's not a lot of color in that scene. Fine. But then they get to London and there's not color. Which, by the way, I love the dialogue. Here it is. We're in London. Oh, it's hideous. Yeah, well, it's not for everybody. it just had charming dialogue is the only way I can put it all the way through. I love the dialogue. But no color. And we go through the entire rest of the movie, and the vast majority of the color palettes in the rest of the movie are muted. And where it really, really bugged me is the scene where she climbs up out of the trench and goes into no man's land. And that was where I thought a different producer would have used color differently, because my choice in that scene would have been to have Diana's outfit be very bright and colorful at that point. We're talking World War I, trench warfare, mud, every tree for miles around, every shrub, every sapling, every blade of grass destroyed and obliterated. The landscape is nothing but mud and dirt and gray. And the soldiers have been living in it. They've got dull-colored uniforms to begin with. This is all historical. Trench warfare in World War I would have been a very dull, colorless affair. That makes sense. But then Diana shows up on the battlefield and does what no one expects, climbing out of the trench, and survives and leads this whole charge across. I thought she needed a colorful uniform, a colorful superhero outfit at that point, to really visually highlight she is something completely different on the battlefield. These men have been stuck here for 3-4 years. Well, not literally, rotated through. But some men or another have been stuck in the same spot for 3-4 years, making no progress, churning the mud deeper and deeper. And then here we go. Bright flash of hope, optimism, something different explodes onto the scene and makes a difference. I thought we needed color there. And it really bugged me that Zack Snyder and the rest of the creative team seemingly disagree, and that not even Wonder Woman in the midst of World War I can get some hopeful optimism in her color scheme. I felt that was a missed opportunity. Now, I'll be clear, giving her color there destroys the rest of the DC universe, because the whole DC universe, it's been well established, everybody has muted color palettes in their superhero outfits, so you can't give her a colorful uniform without giving Superman one, and you can't give Superman one without giving Flash one. You can't give Aquaman one without casting someone other than Jason Momoa as Aquaman. Batman doesn't need one. And you know, my vision for the DC movie universe is that everyone but Batman has a nice colorful costume. And Batman, whenever he enters a room, just sucks all of the light out of it. There's just this perpetual cloud and shadow around Batman. He's always veiled. But that's playing the DC universe more for comedy than I think anybody in control over there wants to. But yeah, their use of color continually frustrates me, and especially in this movie. Again, overall, I really like the movie, but if I'm going to pick one minor nit that bugged me, color is it.
I think that's a great idea, honestly. I think it's probably... would you agree that color kind of goes away to a large degree, or at least it's definitely toned down after Paradise Island?
Yeah, it seems like Paradise Island was presented, and this is probably a deliberate thematic choice.
Exactly.
Of it's where the Greek gods established the last hope for all mankind. So yeah, I agree. It pretty much goes away as soon as they leave the island, but that's exactly why I thought Diana should have been colorful later in the movie, because mm-hmm. she is bringing some of that hope from Paradise Island out into the rest of the world as Zeus intended.
No, I like that. I wish you'd been in the room when they were planning that out. You know, I don't think Zack Snyder is actually allergic to color. Obviously, some decision was made that everything was going to be super dark and gritty and gray at the beginning of at the first DCU meetings. But if you think back to the other stuff he's done, Dawn of the Dead, 300 was sumptuous. Watchmen had its problems, but it wasn't a lack of color. There are some brilliant, and not in the genius sense of the word, but in the color sense, shots in there. This weird computer animated film called Legend of the Guardians, The Owls of Ga'Hoole, which I happen to see. Sucker Punch, parts of it anyway. He does color.
You're right. I was being unfair. I was thinking back to the 300 as being a drab affair, but I'm re-remembering some of those scenes, and no, that was a very colorful movie. So no, I don't think that is a Zack Snyder characteristic. I think that is a DC brain trust characteristic, and it's one I still really do not understand, except insofar as someone said we should be not Marvel, and Marvel is colorful, so therefore we can't be. But if that was the reasoning that went into all of this, I think that was really missing the mark.
I was actually very surprised, by the way, that apparently Steve Trevor did get to sleep with Wonder Woman in the film. This goes back to the gender politics. I actually wrote this down and we didn't get to it. This may be my fundamentalist mindset because I grew up one. And consequently, even though I have abandoned Christianity itself, I tend to think in black and whites, and I tend to skirt around rules and build hedges and so on and so forth. But there was so much pressure on this movie to be extremely, you know, woman positive, that even though I understood that women enjoy sex and that there is nothing inherently wrong with Wonder Woman and Steve Trevor wanting to sleep together or whatever, I thought they would skirt around it. I thought that, because you hear about this, like, I don't know about you, but I see on my Facebook wall or whatever, fellow geeks, women complain that they could have just had them be friends. Why does there always have to be a romance and so forth? Because they're very sensitive to the idea that women are just love interests and so on and so forth. So I thought that in order to play it super safe, because Hollywood is not good at
nuance,
thank you, yes, that Alan Heinberg and Patty would just receive a note not to do that and just to have kind of an unrequited romance. But no, and I liked that. I thought it was a great decision. But I was surprised.
I thought they set it up well, if they were going to do it at all, by having the conversation in the boat that made it clear that Diana was not completely naive. She did know the birds and the bees. And she had grown up with this idea that men are unnecessary for pleasure, and we'll just let the implications of that just disappear subtly under the waves without a trace. But they'd at least set it up that she knew what was going on, and they'd introduce the idea from Steve Trevor himself that she had the wrong idea, and perhaps it was one she might want to reevaluate, such that to me, I agree, I was a little bit surprised that they went ahead with it, but it was set up by earlier in the movie. It did not feel out of place. It felt like a natural evolution of her reevaluating everything that she'd been reevaluating since leaving the island.
Mm. And they did it well. It was a very classic manner of communicating it. It was essentially a pan to the fireplace.
A pan to the fireplace and then a pull back outside where the snow drifts gently down.
Right. Actually, I do think they cut to outside the window. I can't recall.
Yeah. What I'm curious whether or not it's going to get more commentary from the gender politics side of things is that Ares is handling her pretty well until Steve Trevor's plane detonates up in the sky and she gets emotionally distraught at Steve being dead and then explodes and starts beating the crap out of Ares from that point on.
I don't think they'll mind at all. The standard feminist complaint is that women are used to further men's emotional arcs. And in this case, it's the opposite, which is fine by them. Not because they're being hypocrites, but because, you know, we're in this rarer situation where it's a female story. And
right.
In theory, there's nothing wrong with that, because supporting characters are there to forward the main character's emotional arcs.
Right. I agree with you. My thought was just whether anyone would be outraged that she doesn't reach her full potential as her full strength until something happens with the man, that she's incapable of reaching that height on her own. I think it's a bogus criticism. It's just one I'm going to be keeping an eye out on the internet to see if it's one that bubbles across my radar over the next week. If there's any critique of this movie, I'm placing my chip down on, I think that's where it's going to be.
Well, I follow the feminist frequency on Twitter, so if there's anything that can be criticized, I'm going to learn about it, and I'll let you know. I wish I had had the wherewithal to poll my super feminist friends on Facebook, you know, just post on there, hey, folks, if you've seen Wonder Woman, what feminist critique would you make of it? And to see what came up, which I guess is their standard complaint that we don't ask them. So there you go. I'm part of the problem.
Here we are, two white guys discussing a female-led movie with no women in the room.
Right? God, we're just like the healthcare panel right now and everything else.
This has been
a disaster.
We are the problem. We apologize.
Oh.
Enough to destroy the recordings and start over, but we apologize.
Pretty much. I'm already regretting that whole comment about Sidney Poitier. Not least because I'm not even sure if I said his name correctly.
It matches my understanding of the pronunciation, so we're either both right or both wrong.
Well, great minds think alike and fools seldom differ. Well, I don't have any more notes. Closing thoughts, Joe?
Closing thoughts. I don't know if this is going to get me watching DC Universe movies in general. I still have a bad feeling about Justice League, but I enjoyed this one. If people in the family want to buy a copy for the family, I would be in favor of it, and I'm looking forward to the next Wonder Woman movie.
How old are your oldest daughters?
10 and 8.
10 and 8. Okay, so they're slightly older than my sister, so I'm still not going to be able to talk my father into letting me take him. That's a shame. But,
My other closing thought is, I hope this does well enough at the box office to get Marvel to move from greenlighting a Captain Marvel movie to actually putting the stupid thing into production, because I've been hearing rumors for like 2 years now, and I still haven't heard an actual date attached to it.
I've seen dates attached, but they're distant.
They're distant, and I'm hoping this movie is successful enough to get Marvel moving, not because I consider myself a big gender politics person who feels like we must have more female superhero movies because females are awesome, but just because I think there's some good stories out there that Marvel is ignoring that I really wish they wouldn't.
Well, my thoughts are, thank God it's good. I agree that this doesn't equal a buy-in of the DC CU for me. The next movie, of course, is Justice League. My wife is still hyped for that, both because Zack Snyder's previews for Zack Snyder's movies always look good, even if the movies turn out to be terrible, but also because Jason Momoa is in it. And that man is someone I will check guest lists at Comic-Cons before bringing my wife to them.
Whatever his emotional range as an actor may be, boy, does he have the looks.
Yeah, pretty much. I do like the version of Aquaman they're going with, though. That was a sort of a 10-year, I think, period where he was bearded. And I don't know if he has a hook for a hand in this movie, but he had a hook for one at the same time he got the beard. And it was a radical new take on him in like the mid-90s. And it's much more interesting than the bland, pretty much indistinguishable personally from Flash and Green Lantern and Superman version, you know, that existed for most of the 20th century.
I think we've established you have not watched Batman the Brave and the Bold, correct?
No, I have not. What's it like in that one?
I like their take on him in that one. One, super brightly colored orange and green outfit, which is, sounds hideous, but is awesome.
Sounds like a classic one. Okay.
Yeah. And his personality, I don't personally find bland. He is the boaster of the crew. He is the one that is most likely to take a story that he was only peripherally involved in and turn it into a story where he somehow plays the central role as he's retelling it to everyone else. So his personality is as bold as his costume, and he's a heck of a fighter. But he's just always got that element where everyone else is in the background kind of rolling their eyes because he's going to take credit in the friendliest possible way for how the day got saved, whether or not he was centrally involved or not. So it's a bit of a humorous take on the character. And it's one I really enjoy, and it is one I am very, very obviously not going to see with Jason Momoa playing Aquaman.
Hmm. Well, there is, well, we do know, as of this week, that there is going to be one highlight in the upcoming Justice League movie, and that is Wonder Woman.
Yes.
And I think that's a pretty good place to sign off. So thanks for talking, Joe.
Thank you, Adam. Good night.
If you liked the show, help new listeners find it by listening to The Golden Age and rating it in Apple Podcasts. Just go into Apple Podcasts, subscribe to The Golden Age, and rate it. You can also see announcements for new shows, episodes, and upcoming live streams by following @FromVoxDuo on Twitter. Joe blogs at MinorThoughts.com and is on Twitter @JMartinDF. Adam is on Twitter as well @AdamVolley. That's Adam, VOLLE.